Why would I want to do that? Zimbalist says. I wouldn't board my mother-in-law's chihuahua in that flea bag. He unplugs the kettle before the water is boiled and soaks the tea bags, 1, 2, 3. He puts the glasses on a tray with a pot of jam and 3 small spoons, and they sit down at his desk in the corner. The tea bags surrender their color unwillingly to the tepid water. Lanzmann hands around papyruses and lights them. From the vans come the sounds of men shouting or laughing. Lanzmann isn't quite sure. Vina walks around the workshop, admiring the mass and variety of string, stepping carefully to avoid a tumbleweed of knotted wire, gray rubber with a blood-red copper stump. "Ever make a mistake?" Vina asks the boundary maven. "Tell someone he can carry where he's not allowed to carry? Draw a line where no line needs to be drawn?" "I don't dare to make mistakes," the Zimbalist says. "Carrying on the Sabbath, it's a serious violation. People start thinking they can't rely on my maps, I'm through." "We still don't have a ballistic fingerprint on the gun that killed Mendel Spielman," Vina says with care. "But you saw the wound, Meyer." "I did. Did it look like it was made by, say, a Glock or a Tech-9 or any kind of an automatic?" "In my humble opinion," Lanzmann says, "no. You spent a lot of quality time with Litvak's crew and their firearms." "And loved every minute. Did you see anything in their toy box that was not an automatic?" "No," Lanzmann says. "No, Inspector, I did not." "What does that prove?" Zimbalist says, easing his tender bottom down onto the inflatable donut cushion of his desk chair. "More importantly, why should I care? Aside from your general personal interest in seeing justice done in this matter, of course," says Bina. "Aside from that," Zimbalist says. "Detective Lanzmann, do you think Alter Litvak killed Spielman or ordered him killed?" Lanzmann looks right into the boundary maven's face and says, "He didn't. He wouldn't. He didn't just need Mendel. The Yid had started to believe in Mendel." Zimbalist blinks and fingers the blade of his nose, thinking this over, as if it is the rumor of a newborn creek that will force him to redraw one of his maps. "I do not buy it," he concludes. "Anybody else. Everybody else. Not that Yid." Lanzmann doesn't bother to argue. Zimbalist reaches for his tea. A vein of rust twists in the water like the ribbon in a glass marble. "What would you do if something you had been telling everybody was one of the lines on your map," Bina says, "turned out to be, say, a crease, a hair, a stray pen mark, something like that? Would you tell anyone? Would you go to the Rebbe? Would you admit that you made a mistake?" "It would never happen." "But if it did, would you be able to live with yourself?" "If you knew you had sent an innocent man to prison for many years, Inspector Gelbfish, for the rest of his life, would you be able to live with yourself?" "It happens all the time," Bina says. "But here I am." "Well, then," the maven says, "I guess you know how I feel. By the way, I use the term innocent very loosely." "As do I," says Bina. "No doubt about it." "My whole life, I knew only one man I would use that word to describe." "You're ahead of me, then," Bina says. "Me too," says Lanzmann, missing Mendel Spielman as if they had been for many years the best of friends. "I am very sorry to say." "You know what people are saying," Zimbalist says, "these geniuses I dwell among? They're saying Mendel's coming back, that it's all happening just the way it was written, that when they get to Jerusalem, Mendel is going to be there, waiting for them, ready to rule over Israel." Tears start to run down the boundary maven's sallow cheeks. After a moment, Bina removes a handkerchief from her bag, clean and pressed. Zimbalist takes it and looks at it for a moment. Then he blows a great takia on his chauffeur of a nose. "I would like to see him again," he says. "I will admit it." Bina hoists her bag to her shoulder, and it resumes its steady mission to drag her down. "Get your things together, Mr. Zimbalist." The old man appears startled. He puffs his lips as if trying to light an invisible cigar. He picks up a loop of rawhide thong lying on his desk, ties a knot in it, and puts it down again. Then he picks it up and unties it. "My things," he says finally. "Are you saying I'm under arrest?" "No," Bina says. "But I would like you to come down so that we can talk some more. You might want to call your lawyer." "My lawyer," he says. "I think you took Alter Litvak out of his hotel room. I think you've done something with him, put him on ice.
possibly killed him.
I'd like to find out.
You have no evidence, Zimbalist says.
You're just guessing.
She has a little evidence, Lonsman says.
About 3 feet, says Bina.
Can you hang a man with 3 feet of rope, Mr. Zimbalist?
The maven shakes his head, half irritated, half amused, his poise and his bearings regained.
You're just wasting my time and yours, he says.
I have a huge amount of work to do.
And you, by your own admission, by your own theory, have not found whoever it was that killed Mendela. So with all due respect, why don't you just worry about that, all right, and leave me alone? Come back when you've caught the supposed actual killer, and I'll tell you what I know about Litvak, which at the moment, by the way, is officially and everlastingly nothing.
It doesn't work that way, Lonsman says.
All right, says Bina.
All right, Zimbalist says.
Lonsman looks at Bina.
All right?
We catch whoever killed Mendel Spielman, Bina says. You give us information. Helpful information about Litvak's disappearance.
If he's still alive, you give me Litvak.
You have a deal, the Boundary Maven says.
He thrusts out his right claw, all spots and knuckles, and Bina shakes it.
Lonsman, feeling stunned, gets up and shakes hands with Boundary Maven. Then he follows Bina out of the shop into the waning day, and his shock intensifies when he finds that Bina is crying. Unlike Zimbalist's, hers are tears of fury.
I can't believe I did that, she says, availing herself of a tissue from her endless stash.
That is the kind of thing you would do.
People I know keep having that problem, Lonsman says, suddenly acting like me.
We're law officers. We uphold the law.
People of the book, Lonsman says, as it were.
Fuck you.
Do you want to go back in there and arrest him, he says?
We can. We have the cable from the tunnel. We can hold him. Start from there.
She shakes her head.
The bachelor, on his map of stains, is staring at them, hitching up the seat of his black serge trousers and taking it all in. Lonsman decides he'd better get her out of there. He puts his arm around her for the first time in 3 years and ushers her over to the supersport, then goes around to his side and climbs in behind the wheel.
The law, she says. I don't even know what law I'm talking about anymore. Now I'm just making this shit up.
They sit silently as Lonsman wrestles with the perennial detective problem of being obliged to state the obvious.
I kind of like this new crazy, confused Bina and all, he says.
But I feel I have to point out that we have no real leads on the Spielman case, no witnesses, no suspect.
Well, then, you and your partner had better fucking get me a suspect, she says, hadn't you?
Yes, ma'am.
Let's go.
He starts the ignition, puts the supersport in gear.
Hold on, she says.
What's that?
Across the plots, a big black 4x4 pulls up around the east side of the Rebbe's house. Two Rudashevskis get out of it. One goes around to open the rear gate of the vehicle. The other waits at the bottom of the side steps, hands knotted loosely behind him. A moment later, two more Rudashevskis come out of the house, humping several hundred cubic meters of what appears to be hand-painted French luggage. Quickly and with little regard for the laws of solid geometry, the four Rudashevskis manage to fit all of the trunks and bags into the back of the 4x4. Once they have accomplished that feat, a big chunk of the house itself breaks off and falls into their arms, wearing a gorgeous fawn-colored alpaca coat. The verb of a Rebbe does not look up, or back, or around at the world he rebuilt and is now abandoning. He lets the Rudashevskis do their quantum origami on him, folding him and his canes into the back seat of the 4x4. The Yid just joins his luggage and rolls on. 55 seconds later, a second 4x4 pulls up, and two women in long dresses, heads covered, are helped into the back along with their city of baggage and a number of children. The process is repeated with females and children and black 4x4s for the next 11 minutes.
I hope they have a very big airplane, Lonsman says.
I didn't see her, Bina says. Did you see her?
I don't think so.
Half a second later, Bina's chauffeur rings.
Gelfish.
Yes.
We did wonder.
Yes.
I understand.
She snaps the phone shut.
Drive around the back of the house, she says. She saw your car. Lanzmann guides the supersport through a narrow alley and into a courtyard behind the Rebbe's house. Apart from the car, there is nothing that would have been out of place 100 years ago. Stone flags, stucco walls, leaded glass, a long half-timbered gallery. The flags are slick, and water drips from a row of potted ferns that hang from the underside of the gallery.
She's coming out?
Bina doesn't answer, and after a moment a blue wooden door opens in a low wing of the great high house. The wing is set at a crooked angle to the rest of the building, and it sags with picturesque accuracy. Bathsheba Spielman is still dressed more or less for a funeral, her head and face wrapped in a long sheer veil. She doesn't cross the gap of perhaps 8 feet separating her from the car. She just stands on the doorstep with the faithful bulk of Sprinzel Rudashevsky looming in the shadows behind her. Bina rolls down the window on her side.
"You aren't leaving?" she says.
"Did you catch him?"
Bina doesn't play games or act stupid. She just shakes her head.
"Then I'm not leaving.
It might take a while. It might take longer than we really have."
"I certainly hope not," says Mendel Spielman's mother.
"That man Zimbalist is sending his idiots in their yellow pajamas over here to number every stone in this house so that it can be disassembled and then reassembled in Jerusalem. If I'm still here in 2 weeks, I'm going to be sleeping in Sprinzel's garage."
"It would be my very great honor," says what is either a very grave talking donkey or Sprinzel Rudashevsky from behind the Rebbe's wife.
"We will catch him," Bina says.
"Detective Lanzmann just swore me an oath to that effect."
"I know what his promises are worth," Mrs. Spielman says.
"So do you."
"Hey," Lanzmann says, but she has already turned and gone back into the crooked little building from which she emerged.
"All right," Bina says, clapping her hands together. "Let's get started. What do we do now?"
Lanzmann taps the wheel, considering his promises and their worth. He was never unfaithful to Bina, but there is no doubt that what broke the marriage was Lanzmann's lack of faith. A faith not in God, nor in Bina and her character, but in the fundamental precept that everything befalling them from the moment they met, good and bad, was meant to be. The foolish coyote faith that could keep you flying as long as you kept kidding yourself that you could fly.
"All day I've been craving stuffed cabbage," he says.
45. From the summer of 1986 to the spring of 1988, when they defied the wishes of Bina's parents and moved in together, Lanzmann sneaked in and out of the Gelbfish home to make love with her. Every night, unless they were quarreling, and sometimes in the thick of a quarrel, Lanzmann climbed the drainpipe and tumbled in through Bina's bedroom window to share her narrow bed. Just before dawn, she would send him back down again. Tonight it took him longer and cost him more effort than his vanity would care to admit. As he passed the halfway mark, just above Mr. Oischer's dining-room window, Lanzmann's left loafer slipped, and he dangled free and thrilling over the black void of the Gelbfish backyard. The stars overhead, the bear, the snake, exchanged places with the rhododendron and the wreckage of the neighbor's hookah. In regaining a purchase, Lanzmann tore the leg of his trousers on the aluminum bracket, his old enemy in the struggle for control of the drainpipe. Foreplay between the lovers commenced with Bina balling up a tissue to blot the cut on Lanzmann's shin. His shin with its blotches and freckles, with its strange midlife bloom of black hair. They lie there on their sides, a couple of aging yids stuck together like pages of an album. Her shoulder blades dig into his chest. The knobs of his patellas are notched against the soft, moist backs of her knees. His lips can blow softly across the teacup of her ear. And a part of Lanzmann that has been the symbol and the site of his loneliness for a very long time has found shelter inside of his commanding officer, to whom he was once married for 12 years. Although, it's true, his tenure inside her has grown precarious. One good sneeze could pop him loose.
"The whole time," Bina says. 2 years.
"The whole time."
"Not once."
"Not even."
"Weren't you lonely?"
"Pretty lonely."
"And blue?"
"Black. But never black or lonely enough to kid myself that having sex with a random Jewess was going to make me feel any less."
"Actually, random sex only makes it worse," she says.
"You speak from experience."
"I fucked a couple of men in Yaakovy, if that's what you want to know. It's strange, Lonsman says upon reflection. But I think I do not.
A couple or three.
I don't need a report.
So new, she says, so you just beat off?
With a discipline you might find surprising in a yid so unruly.
And what about now, she says.
Now?
Now is madness, he says.
Not to mention uncomfortable. Plus I think my leg is still bleeding.
I meant, she says, what about now? Do you feel lonely?
You're kidding, right? Squashed into this bread box?
He buries his nose in the thick, soft rasp of Bina's hair and takes a deep breath. Raisins, vinegar, a salt whiff of the sweat of her nape.
What does it smell like?
It smells red, he says.
It does not.
It smells like Romania.
You smell like a Romanian, she says, with shockingly hairy legs.
I've become such a geezer.
Me too.
I can't even climb stairs. My hair's falling out.
My ass is like a topographical map.
He confirms this information with his fingers. Ridges and depressions, here and there a pimple in high relief. He threads his hands under and over her waist and reaches around to weigh a breast in each hand. At first he retrieves no memory of their former size or estate to compare them with, and he panics a little. Then he decides that they are the same as they have always been, spanned exactly by his palm and his outstretched fingers, formed from some mysterious compound of gravity and give.
I'm not going back down that drainpipe, he says. I can tell you that much.
I said you could just take the stairs. The drainpipe was your idea.
It was all my idea, he says. It was always my idea.
Don't I know it, she says.
They lie there for a long time without saying anything more. Lonsman can feel the skin beside him slowly filling with dark wine. A few minutes later, Bina begins to snore. There is no doubt that her snoring has not changed in 2 years. It has a double reeded hum, the bumblebee continuo of Mongolian throat singing. It has the slow grandeur of a whale's respiration. Lonsman begins to drift across the surface of her bed and of the susurration of Bina's breath. In her arms, in the scent of her on the bed linens, a strong but pleasant smell like new leather gloves, Lonsman feels safe for the first time in ages. Drowsy and content.
Here you go, Lonsman, he thinks. Here is the smell of fine gloves and the hand on your belly that you traded for a lifetime of silence.
He sits up, wide awake and hateful to himself, craven, more unworthy than ever of the fine kidskin woman in his arms.
Yes, all right, Lonsman understands. So go shit in the ocean. That he made not the right but the only choice.
He understands that the necessity of covering up for the dark deeds of the boys in the top drawer is one that Nazis have been making into a virtue since the dawn of police work. He understands that if they were to try to tell someone, say, Dennis Brennan, what he knows, then the boys in the top drawer would find another way to silence him, this time on their own terms. So why is his heart running like a jailbird's steel cup along the bars of his ribcage? Why does Bina's fragrant bed suddenly feel like a wet sock, a pair of underpants riding up on him, a wool suit on a hot afternoon? You make a deal, take what you can get, move on. Get over it. So distant men in a sunny country have been lured into killing one another so that while their backs are turned, their sunny country can be boosted and fenced. So the fate of the Sitka district has been sealed. So the killer of Mendel Spielman, whoever it was, is walking around free.
So what?
Lonsman gets out of the bed. Discontentment gathers like ball lightning around the chessboard in the pocket of his coat. He unfolds it and contemplates it and thinks, I missed something in the room. No, he didn't miss anything. But if he missed something, it's gone by now. Only he didn't miss anything in the room. But he must have missed something. His thoughts are a tattoo needle inking the spade on an ace. They are a tornado going back and forth over the same damn pancake trailer. They narrow and darken until they describe a tiny black circle, the hole at the back of Mendel Spielman's head. He recreates the scene in his imagination, as he saw it that night when Tenenbaum knocked on his door. The freckled expanse of pale back, the white underpants, the broken mask of the eyes, the right hand tumbled from the bed to brush the floor with its fingers, the chessboard on the nightstand. Lanzmann lays the board on Bina's nightstand, and the pail of dim light from the lamp, a yellow porcelain affair with a big yellow daisy on the green shade, white facing the wall, black, Spielmann, Lanzmann, facing the middle of the room. Maybe it's the context at once familiar and strange, the painted bedstead, the daisy lamp, the daisies on the wallpaper, the dresser in whose top drawer she used to keep her diaphragm. Or maybe it's the lingering traces of endorphin in his bloodstream. But as Lanzmann stares at the chessboard, staring at a chessboard for the first time in his life feels good. It feels pleasurable, in fact. Standing there, moving the pieces in his mind, seems to slow or at least to dislodge the needle inking over the black spot in his brain. He focuses on the promotion at B8. What if you change that pawn to a bishop, a rook, a queen, a knight? Lanzmann reaches for a chair to take White's place at the board, to sit down in his imagination for a friendly game against Spielmann. There's a chair at the desk, painted to match the daisy-green bed in the corner of Bina's room. It's right about where the fold-down desk would be in relation to the bed in Spielmann's room at the Zamenhof. Lanzmann lowers himself into the green chair, eyes on the board. A knight, he decides. And then Black has to move the pawn at D7. But to where? He settles in to play it out, not because of some forlorn hope that it might lead him to the killer, but because he really needs, all of a sudden, to play the game out. And then, as if the seat is wired to administer a charge, Lanzmann leaps to his feet. He yanks the green chair one-handed into the air, four round indentations in the low-pile white carpet, faint but distinct. He always assumed that Spielmann, as the reception clerks all reported, never had visitors, that the game he left behind was a form of chess solitaire played from memory, from the pages of 300 chess games, maybe just against himself. But if Spielmann did have a visitor, maybe that visitor pulled up a chair to sit down at the board across from his opponent, across the cardboard chessboard from his victim. And that phantom Potzer's chair would have left indentations in the carpet. No doubt by now they have faded or been vacuumed over, but they might be visible in one of Springer's photographs, boxed up in some storage room at the forensic lab. Lanzmann steps into his trousers, buttons his shirt, knots his tie. He takes his coat from the door and, carrying his shoes, goes to pull the covers more snugly over Bina. As he bends to switch off the bedside light, a rectangle of paper falls out of his coat pocket. It's the postcard he received from the gym that he used to frequent, with its offer of a lifetime membership good for the next 2 months. He studies the glossy side of the card with its enchanted Jew. Before, after. Fat, thin. Start here, finish there. Wise, happy. Chaos, order. Exile, homeland. Before, a neat diagram in a book, its grid carefully cross-hatched at the black squares, and annotated like a page of Talmud. After, a battered old chessboard with a Vicks inhaler at B8. Lanzmann feels it then. A hand laid on his, 2 degrees warmer than normal, a quickening, an unfurling like a banner in his thoughts, before and after. The touch of Mendel Spielmann, moist, electric, conveying some kind of strange blessing on Lanzmann. And then nothing but the cold air of Bina Gelbfisch's childhood bedroom. The flowering O'Keefe vagina on the wall. The stuffed schnappish sagging on a bookshelf beside Bina's wristwatch and her cigarettes. And Bina, sitting up in bed, propped on an elbow, watching him. Sort of the way she watched those kids go after that hapless penguin piñata. "You still do that humming thing," she says, "when you're thinking. Like Oscar Peterson, only with no piano." "Fuck," Lanzmann says. "What, Maya?" "Bina!" It's Gloria Gelbfisch, that old whistling marmot from across the hall. An ancient terror momentarily seizes Lanzmann. "Who is there with you?" "Nobody, Pa. Go to sleep." Again, she says in a low whisper. "Maya, what?" Lanzmann sits down on the edge of the bed. Before, after. The exaltation of understanding, then understanding's bottomless regret. "I know what kind of a gun killed Mendel Spielmann," he says. "All right," Bina says. "It wasn't a chess game," Lanzmann says after a moment. on the board in Spielman's room. It was a problem. It seems obvious now. I should have seen it. The setup was so freaky. Somebody came to see Spielman that night, and Spielman posed him a problem, a tricky one. He moves the pieces of the pocket chess set, his grasp of them sure, his hand steady. White is all set up to promote his pawn, see? And he wants to promote it to a knight. That's called underpromotion, because usually you want to get yourself a queen. With a knight here, he has three different ways to mate, he thinks. But that's a mistake, because it leaves black, that was Mendel, with a way to drag the game out. If you're white, you have to ignore the obvious thing. Just make a dull move with the bishop, here at c2. You don't even notice it at first. But after you make it, every move black has leads directly to a mate. He can't move without finishing himself. He has no good moves.
No good moves, Bina says.
They call that zugzwang, Lanzmann says. Forced to move. It means black would be better off if he could just pass.
But you aren't allowed to pass, are you? You have to do something, don't you?
Yes, you do, Lanzmann says. Even when you know it's only going to lead to you getting checkmated.
Lanzmann can see it's starting to mean something to her. Not as evidence or proof or a chess problem, but as part of the story of a crime. A crime committed against a man who found himself left with no good moves at all.
How'd you do that, she says, unable to suppress completely a mild astonishment at this evidence of mental fitness on his part.
How'd you get the solution?
I saw it, actually, Lanzmann says, but at the time I didn't know I was seeing it. It was an after picture. The wrong picture, actually, to the before picture in Spielman's room. A board where white had three knights. Only chess sets don't come with three white knights. So sometimes you have to use something else to stand in for the piece you don't have. Like a penny or a bullet? Any kind of thing a man might have in his pocket, Lanzmann says. Say a Vicks inhaler.
46. The reason you never developed a chess, Myla, is because you don't hate to lose badly enough.
Hertz Schemitz sprung from the hospital with a nasty flesh wound, and that Sitka General smell on him of onion broth and wintergreen soap, is lying on the couch in his son's living room, his thin shanks sticking out of his pajamas like two uncooked noodles. Esther Malka has a ticket for Berko's big leather armchair, with Bina and Lanzmann in the cheap seats, a folding stool and the armchair's leather ottoman. Esther Malka looks sleepy and confused, hunkered down in her bathrobe, her left hand fiddling with something in the pocket that Lanzmann figures for last week's pregnancy test. Bina's shirt is untucked and her hair is a mess. The effect partakes of shrubbery, some kind of ornamental hedge. Lanzmann's face in the pier glass on the wall is an impasto of shadows and scurf. Only Berko Schemitz could look sharp at this little hour of the morning, perched on the coffee table by the couch, clad in a pair of rhinoceros gray pajamas, neatly creased and cuffed, his initials worked over the pocket in mouse gray crewel, hair combed, cheeks eternally innocent of whisker or blade.
I actually prefer losing, Lanzmann says. To be honest, I start winning, I get suspicious.
I hate it. Most of all, I hated losing to your father.
Uncle Hertz's voice is a bitter croak, the voice of his own great-aunt calling out from beyond the grave with a Vistula. He's thirsty, tired, rueful, and in pain, having refused any medication stronger than aspirin. The inside of his head has got to be ringing like the slammed hood of a car.
But losing to Alter Litvak, that was almost as bad.
Uncle Hertz's eyelids flutter, then settle over his eyes. Bina claps her hands, one, two, and the eyes snap open.
Talk, Hertz, Bina says. Before you get tired or go into a coma or something. You knew Spielman.
Yes, Hertz says.
His bruised eyelids have the veined luster of purple quartz or the wing of a butterfly.
I knew him.
You met him how? At the Einstein?
He starts to nod, then tilts his head to one side, changing his mind.
I met him when he was a boy, but I didn't recognize him. When I saw him again, he had changed too much. He was a fat little boy, not a fat man, thin, a junkie. He started coming around the Einstein, hustling chess for drug money. I would see him there. Frank. He wasn't the usual potzer. From time to time, I don't know, I would lose $5, $10 to him.
Did you hate that? Esther Malky says. And though she knows nothing about Spielman at all, she seems to have anticipated or guessed at his answer.
No, her father-in-law says. Strangely, I didn't mind.
You liked him.
I don't like anybody, Esther Malky.
Hertz licks his lips, looking pained, sticking out his tongue. Berko gets out of the chair and takes a plastic tumbler from the coffee table. He holds it to his father's lips, and the ice jingles in the tumbler. He helps Hertz to drain half of it, without spilling. Hertz doesn't thank him. He lies there for a long time. You can hear the water sluicing through him.
Last Thursday, Bina says. She snaps her fingers. Come on. You went to his room, at the Zamenhof. I went to his room. He invited me. He asked me to bring Melech Geistig's gun. He wanted to see it. I don't know how he knew I had it. I never told him. He seemed to know a lot about me that I never told him. And he told me the story. How Litvak was pressing him to play the Tzaddik again, to rope in the Black Hats. How he'd been hiding from Litvak, but he tired of hiding. He had been hiding his whole life. So he let Litvak find him again, but he regretted it right away. He didn't know what to do. He didn't want to keep using. He didn't want to stop. He didn't want to be what he wasn't. He didn't know how to be what he was. So he asked me if I would help him.
Help him how? Bina says. Hertz purses his lips, gives a shrug, and his gaze sidles toward a dark corner of the room. He is nearly 80 years old, and before this he has never confessed to anything.
He showed me that damned problem of his, the mate in two, Hertz says. He said he got it off some Russian. He said if I solved it, then I would understand how he felt.
Zugzwang, Bina says.
What's that? Esther Malky says.
It's when you have no good moves, Bina says, but you still have to move.
Oh, says Esther Malky, rolling her eyes.
Chess.
It's been driving me crazy for days, Hertz says. I still can't get a mate in fewer than three moves.
Bishop to c2, Lanzmann says. Exclamation point. It takes Hertz what feels to Lanzmann like a long time, with his eyes closed, to work it out, but at last the old man nods.
Zugzwang, he says.
Why, old man? Why would he think you would do that for him? Berko says. You barely knew each other.
He knew me. He knew me very well. I don't really know how. He knew how badly I hate losing, that I couldn't let Litvak bring about this foolishness. I couldn't. Everything I worked for all my life.
There must be a bitter taste in his mouth. He makes a face.
And now look what happened. They did it.
You got in through the tunnel, Maya says? Into the hotel?
What tunnel? I walked in the front door. I don't know if you've noticed, Myla, but it's not exactly a high-security building you live in.
2 or 3 long minutes unwind from their spool. Out on their closed-in balcony, Goldie and Pinky mutter and curse and hammer at their beds like gnomes at their forges deep beneath the earth.
I helped him fix himself up, Hertz says finally. I waited till he was under, way deep down under. Then I took Ed Geistig's gun. I wrapped it in the pillow. Geistig's .38 Detective Special. Rolled the boy over onto his belly. Back of the head. It was quick. There was no pain.
He licks his lips again, and Berko is there with another cool swallow.
Too bad you couldn't do as good a job on yourself, Berko says.
I thought I was doing the right thing, that it would put a stop to Litvak.
The old man sounds plaintive, childish.
But then the bastards went ahead and decided to try it without him.
Esther Malka takes the lid from a glass jar of mixed nuts on the table beside the couch and stuffs a handful into her mouth.
Don't think I'm not totally disturbed and horrified about all of this, friends, she says, hoisting herself to her feet. But I'm a tired lady in her first trimester, and I'm going to bed.
I want to sit with him, sweetness, Berko says. He adds, in case he's faking and he tries to steal the television once we're asleep.
Don't worry, Bina says. He's already under arrest. Lanzmann stands by the couch watching the old man's chest rise and fall. Hertz's face has the hollows and facets of a flaked arrowhead. He's a bad man, Lanzmann says. And he always was.
Yes, but he made up for it by being a terrible father.
Berko stares at Hertz for a long time with tenderness and contempt. The old man looks like some kind of demented swami in that bandage.
What are you going to do?
Nothing. What do you mean, what am I going to do?
I don't know. You have that twitchy thing happening. You look like you're going to do something.
What?
That's what I'm asking you.
I'm not going to do anything, Lanzmann says. What can I do? Esther Malka walks Bina and Lanzmann down the hall to the front door of the apartment. Lanzmann puts on his pork pie hat.
So? Esther Malka says.
So? Say Bina and Lanzmann.
I note that the two of you are leaving together.
You want us to leave separately, Lanzmann says. I can take the stairs and Bina can ride down in the elevator.
Lanzmann, let me tell you something, Esther Malka says. All these people rioting on the television in Syria, Baghdad, Egypt, in London, burning cars, setting fires to embassies. Up in Yakovy, did you see what happened? They were dancing, those fucking maniacs. They were so happy about all of this craziness, the whole floor collapsed right onto the apartment underneath. A couple of little girls sleeping in their beds, they got crushed to death. That's the kind of shit we have to look forward to now. Burning cars and homicidal dancing. I have no idea where this baby is going to be born. My murdering, suicidal father-in-law is sleeping in my living room. Meanwhile, I'm getting this very strange vibration from the two of you. So let me just say that if you and Bina are planning to get back together, excuse me, but that's all I need.
Lanzmann considers this. Any kind of wonder seems likely. That the Jews will pick up and set sail for the Promised Land to feast on giant grapes and toss their beards in the desert wind. That the temple will be rebuilt speedily and in one day. War will cease, ease and plenty and righteousness will be universal, and humankind will be treated to the regular spectacle of lions and lambs cohabiting. Every man will be a rabbi, every woman a holy book, and every suit will come with two pairs of pants. Meyer's seed, even now, may be wandering through darkness toward redemption, striking at the membrane that separates the legacy of the Yids who made him from that of the Yids whose errors, griefs, hopes, and calamities went into the production of Bina Gelbfish.
Maybe it would be better if I took the stairs, Lanzmann says.
You go right ahead and do that, Meyer, says Bina. But then when he finally makes it all the way down, he finds her at the bottom waiting for him.
What took you so long, she says.
I had to stop a time or two on the way.
You need to quit smoking.
Quit again.
I do.
I will.
He fishes out his package of Broadway's, 15 left to burn, and arcs it into the lobby trash can like a dime carrying a wish into a fountain. He's feeling a little giddy, a little tragic. He is ripe for the grand gesture, the operatic mistake. Manic is probably the word. But that's not what held me up.
You're really hurt. Tell me you're not really hurt, walking around so tough and macho when you need to be in the goddamn hospital.
She reaches for his windpipe with the fingers of both hands, ready as ever to choke the life from Lanzmann to show how much she cares.
Are you hurt badly, you idiot?
Only in my soul, sweetness, Meyer says. Though he supposes it's possible that Rafi Zilberblatt's bullet creased more than his skull. I just had to stop a couple of times to think. Or not to think, I don't know. Every time I let myself try to, you know, breathe just for 10 seconds, with the air full of this thing we're letting them get away with, I don't know, I feel like I'm suffocating a little bit.
Lanzmann sinks onto a sofa whose bruise-colored cushions give off a strong Sitka odor of mildew, cigarettes, a complicated saltiness that is part stormy sea, part sweat on the lining of a wool fedora. The lobby of the Dnieper is all blood-purple velvet and gilded crust, blown-up hand-tinted postcards of the great Black Sea resorts in Tsarist times. Ladies with their lapdogs on sun-struck promenades, grand hotels that never housed a Jew.
It's like a stone in my belly, this deal we made, Lanzmann says, just lying there.
Bina rolls her eyes, hands on her hips, glances at the door. Then she comes over and drops her bag and plops down beside him.
How many times, he wonders, can she have enough of him already, and still have not quite enough?
I can't really believe you agreed to it, she says.
I know. I'm supposed to be the brown nose around here.
Tell me about it.
The ass licker.
It's killing me.
If I can't rely on you to tell the big shots to fuck off, Meyer, why do I keep you around?
He tries to explain to her, then, the considerations that led him to make his own personal version of the deal. He names some of the small things, the canneries, the violinists, the marquee of the Barnoff Theater, that it pleased him to cherish about Sitka when he was coming to terms with Cash Dollar.
You and your goddamn heart of darkness, Bina says.
I'm not sitting through that movie ever again.
She shrinks her mouth down to a hard mark.
You forgot something, asshole. On your sweet little list. You were one item short, I'd say.
Bina, you have no place for me on that list of yours? Because I hope you know you're at the fucking top of mine.
How is that possible, Lonsman says.
I just don't see how that could be.
Why not?
Because, you know, I failed you. I let you down. I feel like I just let you down so badly.
In what way?
Because of what I made you do. To Django. I don't know how you could even stand to look at me.
Made me? You think you made me kill our baby?
No, Bina, I... Let me tell you something, Meyer.
She grabs his hand, digging her nails into his skin. The day you ever have that much control over my behavior, it will be because somebody's asking you, should she get the pine box or a plain white shroud? She discards his hand, then retrieves it and strokes it at the fiery little moon she carved into his flesh.
Oh, my God, your hand. I'm sorry. Meyer, I'm sorry.
Lonsman, of course, is sorry, too. He has already apologized to her several times, alone and in the presence of others, orally and in writing, formally in measured phrases and in untrammeled spasms.
Sorry, I'm sorry, I'm so, so sorry.
He has apologized for his craziness, his erratic behavior, his glooms and jags, for the years of round-robin exaltation and despair. He has apologized for leaving her and for begging her to take him back again and for breaking down the door to their old apartment when she declined to do so. He has abased himself and rent his garments and groveled at her shoes. Most of the time, Bina has, good and caring woman that she is, offered Lonsman the words he wanted to hear. He has prayed to her for rain and she has sent cool showers. But what he really requires is a flood to wash his wickedness from the face of the earth. That or the blessing of a Yid who will never bless anyone again.
It's all right, Lonsman says.
She gets up and goes over to the lobby trash can and fishes out Lonsman's package of Broadways. From her coat pocket, she pulls a dented Zippo bearing the insignia of the 75th Ranger Regiment and lights a papyrus for each of them.
We did what seemed right at the time, Meyer. We had a few facts. We knew our limitations. And we called that a choice. But we didn't have any choice. All we had was, I don't know, three lousy facts and a boundary map of our own limitations. The things we knew we couldn't handle. She takes her Schoeffer out of her bag and hands it to Lonsman. And right now, if you're asking me, and I kind of got the idea you were, you also don't really have any choice.
When he just sits there holding the phone, she flips it open and dials a number and puts it into his hand. He raises it to his ear.
Dennis Brennan, says the chief and sole occupant of the Sitka Bureau of that major American daily.
Brennan, it's Meyer Lonsman.
Lonsman hesitates again. He covers the mouth hole of the phone with a thumb.
Tell him to get his big head down here and watch us arrest your uncle for murder, Bina says.
Tell him he has 20 minutes.
Lonsman tries to weigh the fates of Berko, of his uncle Hertz, of Bina, of the Jews, of the Arabs, of the whole unblessed and homeless planet, against the promise he made to Mrs. Spielman and to himself, even though he had lost his belief in fate and promises.
I didn't have to wait for you to drag your lamentable hide down those lousy stairs, Bina says.
You know that. I could just have walked out of the goddamn door.
Yeah, so why didn't you?
Because I know you, Meyer. I could see what was going through your mind, sitting up there, listening to Hertz,
I could see you had something you needed to say. She pushes the phone back to his lips and brushes them with hers. So just go ahead and say it already. I'm tired of waiting. For days, Lanzmann has been thinking that he missed his chance with Mendel Spielman, that in their exile at the Hotel Zamenhof, without even realizing, he blew his one shot at something like redemption. But there is no Messiah of Sitka. Lanzmann has no home, no future, no fate but Bina. The land that he and she were promised was bounded only by the fringes of their wedding canopy, by the dog-eared corners of their cards of membership in an international fraternity whose members carry their patrimony in a tote bag, their world on the tip of the tongue. Brennan, Lanzmann says, I have a story for you.
The End. You've been listening to The Yiddish Policeman's Union by Michael Chabon, narrated by Peter Riegert. We conclude this book with Michael Chabon in conversation with Michael Conroy, where he discusses the inspiration for and the writing of The Yiddish Policeman's Union.
What was the genesis for The Yiddish Policeman's Union? Where did you find the inspiration for the book?
Well, it really grew out of something else that I wrote and the experience of publishing that. I wrote an essay several years ago now in which I responded to this little phrase book that I have that's called Say It in Yiddish, a phrase book for travelers. And this is published as part of a series of Say It books by Dover Publications in New York. There's Say It in Swahili and Say It in Italian and so forth. And they're all, it's in many ways, sort of conventional phrase books with that are divided into sections, you know, in restaurant, at the post office, travel, making travel arrangements, dealing with emergencies, and they provide a sort of standardized list of questions and statements and so on, and then ways of saying it in the various languages. So there's one for Yiddish. And when I first saw this book in a bookstore, I was so struck by it, I bought it immediately. This was many, many years ago. And I had sort of studied and contemplated and thought about this book for a long time thereafter, just wondering, what were the intentions of the people who put together this particular book? Since Yiddish, while it was once spoken by about, say, approximately 11 million people in the world prior to 1939, had suffered, you know, very grievously during the Holocaust, and most of its speakers, or many of its speakers, were killed during the Holocaust, and those who survived were older, and they stopped speaking it. They didn't really transmit it to their children. So there weren't that many speakers of this language to begin with. They never possessed a country of their own, in the sense a place that would have the kind of governmental institutions that this phrase book seemed to imply, like a passport office where you would need to know how to go in and ask somebody in Yiddish, you know, how do I get a new visa for my passport? I was sort of enchanted and saddened and transfixed and puzzled all at once by this phrase book. And finally, I wrote an essay in which I expressed all of those various emotions and tried to imagine, as part of this essay, a possible world or land or place where you would need this phrase book, where you could take this phrase book. And almost in passing, really, in this essay, I referred to a plan that I had read about by which the United States government, the Department of the Interior, to be specific, during just before the Second World War, proposed helping to alleviate the problem of Jewish refugees in Europe wanting to get out, and at the same time exploit the vast untapped natural resources of what was then the Alaska Territory by allowing these European Jews to settle in Alaska as a kind of emergency escape hatch. And this plan never went anywhere. But I just briefly wondered, well, maybe if that had taken place, that would be a place nowadays where you might take this phrase book and it would behoove you to have it. I published this essay and got a very powerful reaction from a very small contingent of Yiddish lovers, Yiddishists, who were very offended by the essay. They were put out by it. They were they felt that I was mocking the Yiddish language, that I was mocking the authors of this phrasebook, Beatrice and Uriel Weinreich. It turned out that Uriel Weinreich was a highly regarded scholar of Yiddish, and he had been sort of viewed as the great hope of the Yiddish language, of academic study of Yiddish, but he died at a very young age, and so to seem to be mocking him was viewed as being a very disrespectful thing. And what was revealed to me through this publishing this essay and then offending people with this essay was both, how touchy some people can be, but also the extent of my ignorance about Yiddish and the world of Yiddish, that I hadn't even known who Uriel Weinreich was. I was embarrassed by that. So I determined to learn more, to study more. At the same time, I'm often motivated in life by an emotion that really there's only a Yiddish word to describe, which is afsaluchas, which means in spite or for spite. And I definitely had a certain degree of afsaluchas, feeling toward these people that I had offended, thinking, you know, well, if that offended them, wait till they get a load of this novel I'm going to write. I'm going to set an entire novel in this imaginary Alaskan territory where Yiddish is the main spoken language. And so both out of a sense of, needing to improve my own relationship to this language that is part of my heritage as a European Jew, a descendant of European Jews, and, also out of a urge just to, you know, make people even more irritated, I started working on this novel.
Let's talk about that history, the alternate history that you create in the Yiddish Policeman's Union. 60-some-odd years, based on this question, what if this sort of throwaway plan had actually happened? And you've constructed a world, an atmosphere. I mean, it informs every part of the novel. But it's so detailed, and it's so believable, and it's so specific. Did you develop the history of the Sitka region and the politics and the way it affected world politics? Did you develop that separately from writing the story of the Yiddish Policeman Union?
Well, I did to an extent. I did repeatedly, actually. But it turned out to be – I started out trying to kind of construct almost in a kind of Tolkien-esque way, you know, to try to construct the history – before I ever started writing the fiction. And I did create a number of timelines and background histories and so on and so forth. But in some ways that turned out to hinder me. When it came time to actually write the novel, I found it unhelpful to adhere too closely to these things I had decided beforehand. And I mean, that's often the case, just generally speaking, with writing fiction. When it comes, you know, I often get asked, like, do you make outlines beforehand before you start writing a novel? And, you know, the answer is yes, I do generally make some kind of an outline, but that outline often turns into an albatross, a millstone around my neck, you know, and I often find myself very, vehemently, you know, jettisoning my outline, with curses for the guy who wrote it, you know. And the same thing happened with this clever sort of world history, alternate world history I created. When I started, it turned out to be not useful to the needs of my characters. And so I was obliged a couple of times in the course of writing drafts of this novel to go back and re-revise and re-ponder and think about the things that had seemed to sort of emerge spontaneously about the world that I was writing about from the words of my characters, the actions of my characters and their interrelationships altered my understanding of the world that I thought they were living in and the nature of that world, so that I revised that fictitious history several times. But it did end up being pretty detailed, and it definitely was not something I just kept in my mind. I made a lot of notes and tried to keep track of what was going on out there in the world. And it is very much an out there in the sense that the world of the Federal District of Sitka has been for many years, 60 years, as you say, a very insular kind of place. It is literally on an island, and they are, you know, the events of the outside world in many ways have left them relatively untouched up until the time that the novel takes place.
Do you start, when you start a fiction, like when you started the fiction of the Yiddish Policeman's Union, as opposed to the fictitious history, do you always start with a character? Did this novel start with the character of Meyer?
Yes, it did. I mean, it typically starts with a voice, I would say, as much as a character. And sometimes the voice and the character are the same. When you have a first-person narrator, then you're sort of simultaneously evolving the voice of the novel and the main character of the novel, if the narrator is the main character, as usually is the case. In this case, I began to sort of evolve a voice that became the voice of Meyer Lanzmann, the homicide detective who's the main character of the book. And I actually wrote an entire draft of it in his voice, in first person, which I probably did initially out of the sense that in some measure I wanted this book to be a kind of homage to and a working through of my great love, lifelong love of writers like Raymond Chandler and the hard-boiled Private Eye novel that typically, and especially in the case of Chandler, classically is written in the first person. You know, it's also the case with something like Ross MacDonald's Lou Archer novels, which I also love. And so I think I made that initial step to have Meyer be telling his own story for that reason. That turned out to be a wrong decision, and in a subsequent draft, I abandoned Meyer's voice, and I went to a third-person narrator, which worked much better for me. But having written that entire draft as Meyer Lanzmann, so to speak, I did really know Meyer Lanzmann by that point, and so that his character, his personality, his way of thinking about things and talking about things was extremely familiar to me as I then started it on the second draft that was not written in first person, that was told by a third-person narrator. But it was nonetheless very close to Meyer Lanzmann.
Right. And the book is still basically, I'm trying to think of a scene now where it's not.
It's all from his point of view.
It is from his point of view. He's involved in every scene. Yeah, absolutely.
Right. The Which problem is sort with of Meyer was he turned out to be a little too garrulous. he likes to talk, and he likes the sound of his own voice, and it was too much. He was talking too much.
Right.
I kind of had to shut him up, and the way that I shut him up was by switching to third person.
Is the novel, as it's finished, The Yiddish Policeman's Union, is the story basically the same story that you set out to tell at
not
the beginning?
Not at all.
No?
Absolutely not. No, I started out with a completely different story, and that first draft that I wrote, that was from Meyer's point of view, was a totally different plot. The characters were more or less the same characters. Their relationships to each other and their feelings about each other were more or less the same, although they did change over time. But the plot itself was entirely different. And I just, in many ways, when I started in on what became the second draft, I said to my wife at the time, you know, this isn't really a new draft I'm writing. It's a sequel. Because it had no, I think from that first draft to the next, I preserved about 30 pages out of, and it was much longer. It was about a 600 page manuscript. I kept about 30 pages in the second draft, and then I wrote two more drafts after that. So, it changed a lot.
Let's talk about detective stories. You just talked about Raymond Chandler and Ross MacDonald. And at a structural level, just at the very basest level, this is a detective story. But you use the conventions of that genre to examine, you know, thematic questions that go far beyond where the conventions of the genre generally do go. Was that your intention? I mean, did you set out to write I hate to use these words, but a literary genre fiction?
I think it was much more of a combination of problem solving with passion. In the sense that, as I said, I do. I mean, Raymond Chandler has always been one of my favorite writers. I reread his work periodically and regularly, and I have done since I first read him when I was a teenager. I keep going back to him. My appreciation for Ross MacDonald came later, and has never quite reached the same level. But those are both two writers, and you know, in a sense, two characters in Philip Marlowe and Lou Archer, who are really important to me, whom I truly love. And the mere sight of one of their books on a bookshelf in a store on my own bookshelves, you know, I get a little tiny glint of a vibration of happiness in my chest just thinking about Farewell, My Lovely, or The Goodbye Look. So there was that love that I felt was sufficient that it could push me through the very long haul of writing a novel. And then secondly, I had this problem to solve, which was the problem of that I was going to be presenting a world that was in many ways going to be unfamiliar to all of my readers, which is very rarely the case. I mean, usually when you present a world in fiction, you figure it's going to be unfamiliar to, you know, some of your readers or perhaps most of your readers, but it's not that often, at least in my experience, that you are presenting a world that's going to be unfamiliar to all of them, because it doesn't in fact exist. I suppose that happens a lot when you're writing fantasy or science fiction. Right. So I needed to figure out a way to ease that transition, to ease the process for my readers of entering this unfamiliar world. I mean, it's not at all a world like Middle Earth, or it is our world in many ways. Recognizably, there are cars, and the cars are all the same makes and models that we have, and there are cell phones and fax machines and you know, cheap hotels, and it's not a completely Salvador Dali kind of a landscape or anything like that. It's our world in many ways, but somebody was going to have to help the reader into it. And it just seemed to me that a detective was a perfect kind of character to do that, because the detective, has access to he can go anywhere he wants. And if he's a homicide detective, if he actually works for the police, he has even more access than a private eye would have. Private eyes are often having the door shut in their face, you know, but a policeman has more access. And I just thought it would be useful to me to tell my story from the point of view of a character who could go wherever he wanted to, talk to whomever he wanted to. He had access to the world of the rich, the poor, Jewish, non-Jewish, that was going to be a useful strategy for storytelling. And so it was really those two impulses that led me to use the form of a detective novel.
It really works, because when you read the book, I think one of the things that makes the world itself so believable and so just amazing is that all the strata of the society are detailed through Meyer's experience, but they're detailed so incredibly well that it feels like a real, it's hard to determine at first when you start reading it that there's something amiss, and you think this isn't quite Alaska, and it's, and then before you actually realize that you're actually in an alternate history. It's a really great aspect of the book.
Thank you.
Sure.
You know, I lost a lot of sweat over that, and that's my great anxiety going into this moment of having people finally reading the book is, you know, have I left everyone in the cold?
Right. No, I loved it. It's also interesting, though, that some of the conventions of the detective story work themselves out really well thematically in the story you're telling as well. I mean, oftentimes we read detectives who are searching for redemption in the solving of a crime, and Meyer sort of is in that same boat, but there's also this idea of redemption and redeemers and kind of messianic doctrine that kind of all works together to tell his story as a character, and it's really quite beautiful.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I mean, I had this... was this a part, you know, it's funny, it's always funny to be talking about these kinds of decisions. You know, starting a novel involves a series of decisions, point of view, tone of voice, tense, style, character, setting, genre, all of these things, all of these different decisions that you have to make. And many of them you sort of have to make right away before you start or as you're starting. And yet a lot of those decisions get made. And in the case of this book, it's very much true that they were all made in a split second. Just detective story, perfect private eye or a homicide detective. And he'll be telling the story and it's going to be from his point of view. And I just had that sense of rightness about the choice that made me just proceed without really thinking about it or questioning it. But, yes, I mean, I think it is built in to my understanding of a character. If you look at a book like The Long Goodbye, and the way that novel is so much about the essence of what it means to be a private investigator, that you've been hired by someone to do this job, and that your loyalty then becomes, your loyalty, which is bought and paid for, becomes sort of the heart and essence of everything you do, to the extreme in that book, in The Long Goodbye, that, you know, Marlowe gets beat up and goes to jail for out of a sense of loyalty to his friend Terry Lennox, that he who hires him to drive him down to Mexico. And I think it's true that in this book, this idea of the detective, the policeman, whose life consists entirely of his work, he has no real life at all outside of his work, which is in many ways it's a cliche of the genre, and it keeps turning up again and again. You can see it most recently in like a show like The Wire, where you have the character of McNulty, the homicide policeman who has no life outside of his work. That sense of trying to find a meaning to life beyond or outside of the work, through the work, a kind of meaning that you might term redemption, of redeeming yourself, of somehow establishing that what you do has value or means something in a larger context, that it's not just about taking the red names on the board for unsolved homicides and turning them black, that there's some larger importance or meaning to it, then does sort of translate to this idea of the larger meaning of redemption for the world.
On sort of another track there, did you start reading detective stories? Is that the genre that began your life as a reader, leading to your life as a writer?
The first genre that I think I loved as a genre, or was even aware of as a genre, was probably fairy tales, and then stories about talking mice. The first writer whose work meant something to me as a writer, of whom I would have said, this is my favorite writer and this man's books are my favorite books, was Sir Arthur Conan Doyle and the Sherlock Holmes stories. So yes, I mean, and that was about the age of 10 or 11 when I fell in love with Conan Doyle and Sherlock Holmes and became very much caught up in the whole world of Holmes and Watson and the canon, as it's called, to be followed shortly thereafter by science fiction and fantasy. In some ways this book is, in addition to being a detective story, it is also science fiction, in that it does postulate the existence, it assumes, let's say, the existence of alternate worlds, of alternate realities, as quantum physics suggests. And it is in this tradition of the counterfactual novel, novels like Fatherland, Len Dayton's SSGB, or Philip K. Dick's The Man in the High Castle, Lest Darkness Fall by Elsbreg de Camp, a novel that's set in a world where the Roman Empire never fell. There is a long, and in some cases, pretty impressive history of fact novels and that are generally subsumed in the larger umbrella of science fiction, and this book is part of that tradition as well.
And a great part of that tradition, if you ask me. I really did enjoy it tremendously. It was a spectacular read, and I wish you a lot of success with it.
Oh, thanks, Michael. I appreciate it.
Absolutely, my pleasure.
That was author Michael Chabon in conversation with Michael Conroy. If you've enjoyed this book and this performance, Recorded Books recommends The Plot Against America by Philip Roth, narrated by Ron Silver. Renowned aviation hero and rabid isolationist Charles A. Lindbergh, immediately upon taking office as the 33rd President of the United States, negotiates a cordial understanding with Adolf Hitler after publicly blaming the Jews for pushing the country toward a pointless war with Germany. Imagining the defeat of Franklin Roosevelt in the 1940 presidential election, Philip Roth recounts what it was like for his Newark family, and for a million such families all over the country, during the menacing years of the Lindbergh presidency, when American citizens, who happened to be Jews, had every reason to expect the worst. You'll find a wide selection of titles in the Recorded Books catalog, including bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more. Call us toll-free or log on to www.recordedbooks.com to learn about our latest releases and special offers, order another recorded book, or to read author interviews and narrator profiles. Don't forget to ask about easy 30-day rentals by mail. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.